Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Illegal fishing is a massive global business. It accounts for up to $23 billion worth of seafood every year and makes up 20% of the fish that Americans eat. One in every five fish Americans consume is illegally caught. For over 40 years, Captain Paul Watson and his crew aboard the Sea Shepherd have worked tirelessly to protect and end illegal fishing and the destruction of and slaughter of wildlife in the world's oceans. In the new documentary, Chasing the Thunder, directors Mark Benjamin and Mark Levin chronicle the dangerous journey of a crew of two Sea Shepherd ships that sail across three oceans and travel over 10,000 miles to shut down one of the most notorious illegal poaching vessels. It's called the Thunder. The film provides a glimpse of what it takes to confront these illegal practices that are depleting our oceans, destroying the marine ecosystem, and robbing coastal communities that depend on fishing for their survival. Captain Paul Watson is the founder of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, the world's most active marine protection nonprofit organization. Paul Watson's career as a master mariner began in 1968 as a seaman with the Merchant Marines and with the Canadian Coast Guard. In 1972, he co-founded the Greenpeace Foundation in Vancouver, and in 1977, he left Greenpeace and founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. And Paul Watson joins us in studio. Hi, thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Captain Adam Meyerson. Adam was chief officer on the Bob Barker for Operation Icefish, and that is the campaign that is the subject of the film Chasing the Thunder. Adam, thank you so much for coming, and it's great to see you in person after watching the amazing work you all did on that ship.
Well, thanks for having me here. It's great to be home in San Francisco.
Yes.
I don't get home very much, but I'm having a good time being back in my old area.
Well, it's great to have you, and we'll talk later in the show about how so many of the people who volunteer are away, even on holidays, to do this really important work. I want to dive in and, first off, talk about the importance of the oceans. It's a really simple question, but it's so important. Paul, you often say what we're looking at is the murder of the ocean, and if the ocean dies, we die.
I think that's the best way to sum it up. If the ocean dies, we die, because it is our life support system on planet Earth. It provides the air we breathe, the food we eat, regulates climate and temperature, and everything stems to the health of the ocean. I always like to compare the Earth to a spaceship. And on every spaceship, you have a life support system. And that life support system is run by a crew. And we're not crew. We're passengers having a good time entertaining ourselves. But what we're doing is killing crew members, those species that run everything. And there's only so many crew members you can remove before the machinery begins to fall apart.
What would you add, Adam?
Well, I just would say in the 30 or so years I've been at sea, you can see places declining all over the world. You'll go days at sea where you won't see birds, which was unusual before. But then you also can see places that are recovering and looking better. I think often off the coast here, it looks better than when I was a kid. There was, the white pelicans were almost gone from DDT. So it is possible to reverse the trends. And I think that we're really at a critical point where we have to really start working to reverse the trends all over the world.
And I have to ask you, before we dive in and talk about what's happening, what is it like to be out in the middle of the ocean, so far away from land?
The best thing in the world. It's, I think, always the leading up to the campaign as the ship's getting ready to go is very stressful. You're getting everything ready, making sure you have everything. And the minute that last dock line is off and the ship sails, it's peaceful and nice. And then, you go and do your mission and you feel like you're actually accomplishing goals. I love it when being out in the middle of the ocean. As soon as the land is gone, I feel at home.
It's amazing because this is something that most people will never experience. When we do shows about coral reefs, most people don't even snorkel. They haven't even been under the water, so they don't know what it looks like. How would you describe that feeling, Paul, being out in the middle of the ocean?
Well, I think, as Adam says, it's a very, very peaceful place to be. You're out of sight and out of control of humanity's superiority over everything. And I find it probably the most peaceful place and time to be. And so I certainly enjoy it, just as Adam does. But, one of the things, one of my concerns is our perception of what the ocean is.
Mm-hmm.
What we usually look upon as the ocean is actually the sea. This is the planet ocean. And what it is water in continuous circulation. And that water is not only in the sea, it's in the atmosphere, it's in the groundwater, it's in the ice, it's in the cells of every single living thing, plant and animal. The water that is in your body right now was once in ice, it was once underground, it was once in a dinosaur's body. It's continually evolving. So the ocean is the planet is the ocean. So this is what I say when, you know, if the ocean dies, we die, because we are the ocean.
And it's all connected. And so we talk about how not only do we not know where so much of our food comes from, but there's so much more than that. Just what you said, all the connections. Yeah, and how that's being affected.
We're actually part of the ocean that's walking around because of all the water that's within our system, which makes up more than our body weight than anything else. Mm-hmm. And so that water today will go into somewhere else. And what we're doing, like for instance, if you look on water as the blood of the earth, when you put a dam on a river, you're cutting off an artery. All of the waste piles up behind it, and the nutrients don't get downstream. So you kill the river by putting a dam on that. And that blood then flows into the estuaries, which act like the liver and the kidneys, and cleanse it, and then sends it, and the sun sends it in a circulatory system. It is a living body.
And you see how that living body is affected when you're out in the middle of the ocean.
Oh, certainly. You know, the different areas of the world we've been in. I just got back from East Africa. I've been working in Tanzania down there. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues they have there is cutting down the mangrove trees to make charcoal. And like Paul's saying, the filters are there in the, you know, as the water comes out in the estuaries. And if you take the mangroves out, then the dirty water goes straight into the ocean. It's never cleaned. So each part of it, you know, is critical to protect. And as you were saying, the oceans are connected. You can get in a boat here in San Francisco and go anywhere that has a coast in the world. Wow. You know, it's just like there is no Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean. It's all one big ocean. The whole planet is one big ocean. Mm.
Paul, can you talk about the overall mission of the Sea Shepherd and how it has changed since you founded it back in 1977?
Well, I established Sea Shepherd originally in 1977 as an anti-poaching organization, an interventionist organization. We don't protest. We intervene. And we implement a thing that I call aggressive nonviolence. And in our entire 41 years of operations, we've never caused an injury to anybody. We've never sustained any serious injuries. And aggressive nonviolence means you're not passive, you're aggressive, but you take pains to not hurt anybody. And we operate within the boundaries of practicality and of the law, although the law can be interpreted in many different ways. But certainly when you're dealing with countries that are violating international conservation law, sometimes you have to break their laws in order to uphold the higher law. It's a very complex sort of thing. But we're very proud of the fact that not only have we never injured anybody, we've never have been convicted of a felony crime for our interventions, for what we're doing. We're really opposing criminal operations.
And it is amazing because in watching Chasing the Thunder, I had almost my hands over my eyes wondering, does the Thunder have guns on board? Is someone going to get hurt? Because we're talking about millions and millions of dollars here, right?
Well, we have been fired upon in our Operation Milagro campaign in Mexico. We're now about to begin our fifth year of operations. And if it wasn't for Milagro, I firmly believe the vaquita, the most endangered species on the planet, our marine mammal species, would be extinct.
Wow.
But in this last season, we had three of our drones shot down. We were fired upon. Fortunately, we carry Mexican sailors with us who can defend our operations. But and there was a shootout between the poachers and the sailors, but fortunately, nobody was injured, but it does show you just how dangerous it can be.
And can you talk, Adam, just about that you have to make last-minute decisions? I don't want to give everything away in the film, but there was something that happened where you all had to really think very quickly. You were possibly putting your lives at risk. You didn't know what was happening on the other boat. How do you navigate all of that?
Well, I mean, that's really the quality that you have to have to work as an officer or a crew on those ships, is to be able to think on your feet and keep yourself safe, because stuff changes constantly, as you can see in the film. You can go from a beautiful calm day to all of a sudden there's a huge emergency going on. And you got to keep in mind at that point we'd been at sea for 110 days of absolute boring following the ship, nothing happening. And, you know, they say that sailing is hours and hours of boredom followed by moments of pure terror, and that one really summed up in that moment of just the change of things happen. And you just have to be, you have to have that mindset that you can think of a solution and move fast and you know, get people to do the right thing.
And the crew is dedicated, is comprised of a very dedicated group of people. I mean, they're putting their lives on the line to do this work. And they're from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have one thing in common. They're fighting to protect the ocean and underwater life.
And that's true. And the bravery of them, because I come from sailing background, you know, I've been to sea before, but I've seen these the crew members come on that have never been on a boat in their life. And they step on that boat that's going to Antarctica. They've never been to Antarctica. They know nothing about the ocean, what it's going to be like. And it always impresses me, the bravery of doing that from a background of never having been to sea, to step on a ship that you're not, you know, you're not going to be able to get off for the next 3 or 4 months, and to commit to that. And it's really impressive to me that they do. And they do a good job. You know, they learn on the ships how to do all the different jobs. And, it's just, it's a real pleasure to work with people like that.
There was a scene, Paul, you kind of make a cameo in this documentary, where one of the captains calls you because they have to make a call. And you say, hey, you're the captain. It's up to you to make this decision.
Well, it always is. You know, you can't micromanage your captains, really.
Right.
And, you know, a captain's abilities are really best defined by how to make decisions on the spot. And the motto that I always live by is every day it's always something. And if it isn't something, it's something else. But it's always going to be something. So always be prepared for the unexpected.
Are you now inundated with applications for volunteering?
We have a lot of applications, yes, and the strength of our organization really is the volunteerism. You know, back in 1911, the London Times criticized Ernest Shackleton because his crew were volunteers. He didn't have professionals. And he says, and thank God for that, too. I don't want professionals. I need the passion of people who are going to get me to where I want to go. We could not pay people to do what these volunteers do for nothing. The risks they take, the hard work they put in, the dirty work they put in. I mean, to pull that net out of the Southern Ocean was 200 hours of hard, disgusting work. And it took, 200 hours to pull 72 kilometers, 70 tons of net out of the ocean.
In very cold water, almost getting hypothermia. I mean, that was really intense to watch. Let's talk about illegal fishing, because a lot of people nowadays, I feel like we're even more disconnected from our food in many ways, even though there's the whole farm to table movement and all of that. But let's talk a little bit about just how big the illegal fishing industry is. How would you explain it?
Well, there's 10 million fishing boats out on the ocean.
10 million.
And each day enough gill net and drift net and long lines and everything are set to go around this planet about 65 times. That's how much gear is being put out there. At the climate change conference in Paris a couple of years ago, they didn't even want to talk about the ocean. Even the ocean is a primary regulator of climate. And I said, look, the solution is very simple. We don't have to do anything. And that means we don't do anything. We leave it alone. Leave the ocean alone. We need to ban all heavy gear fishing technology for at least 50 years. You know, for thousands of years, the shamans in Polynesia, they would declare a bay or an area kapu, taboo. No, nobody fishes here. If you're caught fishing in this bay over the next 20 years, it was a death penalty. And people say, well, that's a little extreme. But the shamans knew something, that if the fish died, they died. And therefore, it was a matter of survival. So they were very, very strict about it. We don't have any kapu areas anywhere in the world today. Rayathon, that sells the fish-finding device, their motto is, the fish can run, but they can't hide.
Wow.
So the fish have nowhere to go. And we're literally wiping out fish. Mm. I was raised in an Eastern Canadian fishing village. I've seen the diminishment of the fishing industries over the years. And, you know, people say we got to respect fishermen. I don't respect fishermen. I was raised with them. Mm. You know, they pollute, they kill, they shoot everything on sight. They're destructive. And until they actually earn my respect by showing some respect for the planet, I'm certainly not going to patronize them and say, oh, you know, they got to, you know, fishermen have their way and they have to, you know, you have to respect them. No, you respect them by their behavior, not just because who they are.
Mm. Well, and there are different types of fishermen, right? I mean, we're talking about massive corporate fishermen and then small mom and pop fishermen.
Yeah, the small mom and pop ones are the problem too,
really?
in my opinion.
Really?
Yeah, but they're the ones that are shooting at everything in sight. But the problem, but there is a problem, is that the large corporate operations pretty much run everything. Mm-hmm. You know, and we never hear about the poor fishermen who are being put out of work. For instance, the Norwegian drag trawler fleet went down the coast of India and took everything, put 1 million fishermen out of work. Young, small fishermen, Well, it wasn't anything in the New York Times about that. Nobody cares about them. They only care about the corporations.
Right.
And almost all fishing now is corporate or and illegal.
Adam, what would you add about illegal fishing? This is a massive operation.
It is, and we're working right now in Tanzania. I just came back from there. And the interesting thing about illegal fishing is that it's intermixed with legal fishing. There's no clear definition between the two. Because when we started doing inspections of the so-called legal boats there that had licenses, the entire fleet left the country's waters because they didn't want to be inspected. Because the first two boats we inspected got arrested because they had shark fins on board. So it's intermixed, and then they also intermix the illegally caught fish with legally caught fish. So they greenwash it, basically, and sell it. As we caught one ship, a shrimp trawler, that had a sustainable fishery certification on it, and it was fishing illegally with different wrong kind of nets. They had closed their turtle excluder devices. They had all these violations. So you can't really tell what's legal and what's not legal when you're buying it. So the best thing to do is not buy any fish at all.
I'd say it was between 35% and 45% of all the fish that's caught is caught illegally.
Yeah. 35% and 40%.
Yeah.
Wow. Sushi's huge here in the Bay Area and many other places across the country. We've got now strip malls that have little sushi joints.
Mm-hmm.
So what are people eating?
Well, a lot of it's illegal and a lot of it's certainly unsustainable. I don't think there is any sustainable fisheries left in the world. We're simply eating the ocean alive. And that's going to have a very bleak outlook for the future. You know, what are we going to do in 50 years when, according to Dr. Boris Worm and Dr. Daniel Pauly, the two foremost fishery biologists in the world, they said by 2048 there won't be any fishing industry because there won't be any fish.
Do you agree with that?
Well, that the evidence certainly points in that direction.
Wow.
I think they're being optimistic.
Really?
Yeah, it's in Africa, the pressure of fishing, especially West Africa, is astonishing. It's just one trawler crossing another trawler, and they're not bringing up anything because, I mean, you look at the catch, it's all fish like this big.
And also, about 40% of the fish that actually is caught isn't eaten by people.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's converted into fish meal and fed to pigs and chickens and domestic salmon and fur-bearing animals and cats.
Right.
Cats eat more fish. Domestic house cats eat more fish than all the seals in the North Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
And chickens are eating more fish than all the puffins and albatrosses in the world.
We just did a show about the billion-dollar fish oil industry and how that's affecting the oceans.
Oh, yeah.
And now krill oil, because fish oil wasn't damaging enough. We have to take the food out of the whale's mouths for a snake oil remedy.
And the problem is that, you know, all life on this planet right now is dependent upon one group of species, and that's the phytoplankton, the plant plankton that lives in the world's oceans. Since 1950, that population has been diminished by about 40%.
Mm-hmm.
It always comes down to around 40% of everything.
Yeah.
But and what happens if that crashes, then everything crashes. And one of the reasons it's crashing is that, aside from the fact that they're now starting to harvest krill, but one of the reasons that it's crashing is because they need nutrients. Phytoplankton needs nutrients, primarily nitrogen and iron. And where do they get them? From the fecal material from whales and dolphins and birds and marine mammals.
Yeah.
So when you lower those, it's like the whales are the farmers of the ocean. So when you remove or diminish whale populations, you diminish phytoplankton populations.
Captain Paul Watson is founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, the world's most active marine protection nonprofit. Paul Watson co-founded the Greenpeace Foundation in 1972 and founded the Sea Shepherd in 1977. We're also joined today by Captain Adam Meyerson. He was chief officer on the Bob Barker for Operation Icefish. That's the campaign that is the subject of Chasing the Thunder. You know, and just was watching this film and then and the focus on the Thunder ship, that's the one thing that kept going through my mind is, wow, this is just one ship. This is a massive undertaking in order to really crack down on illegal fishing. So let's talk a little bit about this. I didn't really know much about the Patagonian and Antarctic toothfish. And when you went to find the Thunder, you were in the most remote fishing ground in the world. And toothfish, a lot of people might say, I've never seen that on a menu.
No.
So that's Chilean sea bass.
That is Chilean sea bass. That's what they say.
It's not a bass.
Yeah, exactly.
these are amazing fish. They're like as tall as I am.
Oh, yeah.
They're just
huge.
And they
live
to be 100 years old.
Yeah. I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
100.
Mm. And they're very slow to reproduce. One of the easiest things to pressure into extinction is a fish like that that lives a long time, slow to reproduce, has very limited area in which it can live. It has to have the right temperatures and the right food to feed. And they've been chased out of Patagonia. That's why there's none there anymore. They can now go to Antarctica.
So the Thunder, we're talking about six boats. They take two trips a year. They make about $5 million a trip. Over the last 10 years, they've made about $60 million in profits.
I think that's just the Thunder.
That's just one boat.
Yeah, because there was six ships that we were looking for, the Thunder being the worst of the bunch that we called the Bandit Six. And we were lucky to find the Thunder right away.
Yeah, lucky, otherwise we'd be chasing the Yongping. I mean, it just doesn't have the same.
Exactly. And by the end of the end of that year, we had caught all of the boats had been caught.
All of them have been shut down. Yeah. They're now slowly moving. There's some that are slowly moving back in there. Yeah. But at least now I think Australia and New Zealand are more cognizant of this and a threat it is to their legal fisheries. And so they may take action. But they were very reluctant. Governments are very reluctant to take action against illegal fishing because there's a complete lack of economic and political motivation to do anything at all. In fact, when we set out to go after the Thunder, the Australian government was very hostile. They actually threatened us with charging us with illegal fishing if we pulled up any of those nets.
Why? Right.
Because we're pulling up nets.
Fishing gear.
That's illegal fishing.
And so why would they want to charge you
because
with that?
Because they're governments and they're embarrassed by the fact that...
That they're not doing that, it.
Yeah, well, they're not doing it. We're out there doing it. In fact, what happened is the New Zealand Navy came along and the Sam Simon was alongside one of the vessels and the New Zealand Navy came along and Sea Shepherd turned it over to the New Zealand Navy. The New Zealand Navy tried to board them. They said, no, you're not allowed on board. So what did the New Zealand Navy do? They went back to New Zealand. They didn't even board it. And later at a parliamentary hearing, the member of parliament said to the admiral of the New Zealand Navy, well, why didn't you board them? Well, it was too dangerous. They said, well, Sea Shepherd was able to do it. And you know what his answer was? Well, respectfully, sir, we're not Sea Shepherd. We're not pirates. So what I always say is sometimes you need pirates to get things done.
Right. Well, and it was amazing to learn about the role that Interpol plays. This is the International Law Enforcement Organization. They're basically encouraging you to go out there and do this.
Well, they are, but that encouragement came after we actually set out. And suddenly, you know, it becomes a news story and suddenly, wow, you know, what are we doing about this? Because those ships were on the Interpol purple list. That meant that they were already designated as criminal operations. And so, but nobody had done anything until the Sam Simon brought that net gear into Mauritius and Interpol came and inspected it.
Yeah. So what has your relationship been like with Interpol in years past?
Well, this is the only relationship except for me. I'm actually wanted on the Interpol red list.
Because, I wasn't going to bring that up.
Yeah, because Japan put me on there. You know, the Interpol red list is for serial killers, war criminals, and major drug traffickers. I'm the only person in history put on that list for a conspiracy to board a whaling ship. Wow. An illegal whaling ship, but that kind of shows you the kind of political power Japan has. That case is being investigated by a European Parliamentary Committee and by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights for abuse by Interpol. But we're actually dealing with two different areas. The people that we're working with on the fisheries are different than that criminal operation that is involved with the Red List.
Yeah.
This is a pre-taped Your Call, and Paul, you just flew into SFO. What happens when you fly?
Oh, I can fly. As long as I'm in the United States, there's nothing that can be done. But say, or I can go to France, and I have no problem in France. But say I go to France and I come back, I can be arrested at the border. It was okay when Obama was president, but not now. Yeah. So I could be arrested at the border and extradited. Even though I'm a U.S. citizen, I could be extradited to Japan without any – they don't want to hear any reasons why. Japan wants you. You're going to Japan. And, you know, in Japan, if I'm sent to Japan, I'll never leave.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about Japan after a break, but just a few more questions about Interpol. Basically, Adam, Interpol was giving you all the authority to place these illegal poachers under arrest.
Yeah, well, they were coordinating arresting them if we went into port. So we kept wondering which port they were going to go. This was our daily game for 90 whatever days that we were at with the Thunder. Of guessing which port they would go in. They would point the nose towards South America, and we'd think, okay, they're going to go, you know, to Uruguay. Maybe they're going to go. And we'd just guess and guess. And so we were constantly keeping Interpol up to date as to where we thought they were going to go and what was going on. And so they could be able then to fly a team in to assist with the arrest once they got into port there.
It was amazing, though. We were getting a lot of cooperation from countries like Nigeria and Malaysia and Indonesia, all these countries that came on board and were very cooperative.
And that really laid the groundwork that that campaign for what we're doing now, because we're working with four governments in Africa and going on adding more and more to that, working directly with them. And that came right out of a result of working with Interpol and with working with the different governments on the Thunder case. So it's made this whole new direction we're able to go in, where we now have government officials on the ships, and we're doing boardings and inspections and arrests with their help, which is really a fantastic new frontier for us.
And we're being invited by governments to help out. So Peru just invited us to come in and stop poaching off of their coast. We're in partnership now with Mexico and with Dominica. And this is something we're getting more and more invitations, because many of these countries just simply do not have the resources to protect themselves from these industrialized outlaw fleets.
Captain Paul Watson is founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, the world's most active marine protection nonprofit. We're also joined by Captain Adam Meyerson. He was chief officer on the Bob Barker for Operation Icefish. That's the campaign that is the subject of the documentary Chasing the Thunder. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls, but you can find out more about the documentary and Sea Shepherd's work at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Captain Paul Watson, the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, the world's most active marine protection nonprofit. He founded it in 1977 after he left Greenpeace. We're also joined by Captain Adam Meyerson. He was chief officer on the Bob Barker for Operation Icefish. That's the campaign that is the subject of the documentary Chasing the Thunder. And you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org and find out about the other incredible work that Sea Shepherd does. You know, when you look at, say, the Thunder, just one illegal ship, it represents so many breakdowns in our society. So you've got no transparency, governments that don't enforce the law, corrupt governments, sweatshop and slave labor on board, because we've done a bunch of shows about people who cannot leave these ships. Yeah. In this case, the workers were from Indonesia. And then the killing of the fish. There's so many layers to this, and it says so much about our society.
Yeah, it's about the most evil you can put in the square footage of a you know, it's compact and it's mobile, and it's, you know, it's easy to evade detection and get away with all of it. It happens all the time.
Also pollution. You know, they just dump their stuff over the side.
Right.
Yeah. And drug smuggling goes on.
Drug smuggling.
The brother of that owner of that ship, I believe, was convicted for smuggling cocaine inside fish.
Fish.
Yeah, they used to call it white tuna, because they would stuff the bellies of frozen tuna with cocaine until that was discovered by U.S. authorities, and they stopped it from coming into the U.S. But that used to be one of the better means of transporting drugs into the U.S. is in the frozen bellies of fish.
Wow. I mean, this says so much about our globalized society now. And we've done shows about how fish are caught in one place, sent another place to be frozen, sent another place to be thawed out. I mean, it's just, how do you unweave all of this?
Yeah, one of the problems is that you put these fishing boats out there, they catch things and they transship at sea. They put it onto a bigger factory or a vessel which hauls it off to who God knows where. But there's no way of keeping track of who's catching what and where they're catching it and what they're catching.
Yeah, I mean, the best thing they have is handwritten logs, and that is so easy to alter, and there's no accountability. You know, some boats have observers on board, but that's the rare thing, and then the observer is out there for months at a time with all the fishermen. Does he really want to get on their bad side?
Because some of the observers have been tossed overboard.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and
well,
people fall overboard boats, you know. It happens, so it's a pretty easy one to get away with.
And in the case of the Thunder, they can burn the evidence.
Exactly.
How do you, well, since you've been doing this for so long, how do you know if a government is going to work with you? And let's say the, well, like Obama to a Trump, if you've got a change, do you see that?
Well, you have to deal with the changes. For instance, for the last 4 years, we've been working in partnership with the Mexican government, and the new government came in, and fortunately, they agree to carry on with it. So, but sometimes a government will come in, and it's just a complete opposite. Like we had that problem with Australia. You had a somewhat sympathetic government in Australia. Now you got a completely Trumpian, totally authoritarian bunch that are running everything now. For instance, to give you an example, we're trying to save the Great Barrier Reef. One of our vessels is up there right now. And the Australian government just gave a $500 million donation to the Great Barrier Reef Foundation. Nobody's ever heard of it. When we look into it, there's only about six people that work for it. But who sits on the board? All the fossil fuel company executives and the wife of the prime minister. Wow. So $500 million. And what are they going to do? Education. They're not going to actually do anything, but just throwing that money away that way, you know.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we're up there trying to do something about it, and we're being attacked by the government for, you know, you people, how can you actually have a ship that burns fuel, and you're up here protesting energy companies? You know, this is the kind of propaganda that they put out. But really, we're not there protesting energy companies. What we're doing is saying we're protesting the fact you want to dump coal tailings onto the Great Barrier Reef. Uh-huh. That's the issue.
What are you all doing to protect the Great Barrier Reef?
Well, we were up there mobilizing the communities up in the north, working very closely with the Aboriginal communities. And, I mean, there's only so much you can do as far as a direct action campaign on something like that, because where do you take action, really? But what we can do there is build up a network of people who are opposed to what the government's doing and expose things like a $500 million donation to this bogus company that's happening. So we're really like just a thorn in their side all the time. That's one of the reasons we don't have charitable tax status in Australia.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Great Barrier Reef Foundation does.
Wow.
Right, and they also, I guess, collected a lot of visual, footage underwater of the areas there, and also in the Great Australian Bight to show all the things that would be damaged if there was, a spill or anything going on there.
We did shut down. We did stop Chevron and Shell from drilling in the Great Australian Bight.
Yeah.
They just pulled out because of our opposition on that. But now Norwegian Statoil is trying to move in, so we got to fight them. It's just one oil company after another.
There always is another.
How many campaigns do you have going on at any given time?
I really don't know. Because we have 15 ships.
15.
Yeah. And at any given time, I'd say there are about 200 volunteers out on the water.
That's amazing.
And Sea Shepherd is no longer an organization. Sea Shepherd is a global movement.
Mm-hmm.
We have about, 32 to 40 different independent entities, and we all work under an umbrella of global, which cooperates and get along remarkably well, strangely enough. but what we all have in common is the vessels that are out to sea. The vessels are not actually run by any one group, but are all by everybody. So we draw upon volunteers from all those different countries.
In 15 ships.
Yeah, we're the largest private navy in the world.
Wow. And these ships, I mean, I don't know much about boats, but wow. I mean, these are impressive ships. They're massive. They're beautiful. You have incredible gear on board.
They're quite a varied fleet. I mean, we go from the Bridge of Bordeaux trimaran of, 33 meters up to the Steve Irwin, which is
the Ocean Warrior, which is the only vessel we actually had built.
Brand new, yeah.
But we also have four former U.S. Coast Guard patrol boats, a former U.S. Coast Guard buoy tender, former Scottish Fisheries vessel. The Bob Barker is actually probably the most interesting of all, because it started off as a whaling ship.
Yeah.
Then it got converted into supporting the fishing fleets off of West Africa. And because of that, it has an incredible fuel capacity. It's one of the reasons that the Thunder couldn't get away. There's 500 tons of fuel on that boat.
I was wondering about
yes.
that.
Oh, yeah. They couldn't they could not outlast the Bob Barker. That wasn't possible for them to do. So it had everything we needed, ice strengthened, fuel capacity, and it was a perfect vessel for that campaign.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a hard to find that combination of vessel ever. I mean, you're looking around for them, and that's a rare ship, really, to have.
And the Sam Simon we bought from the Japanese government. It was a research vessel. It was right alongside the whaling ships. But I set up a company in the U.S., which bought a set up a company in Hong Kong, which set up a company in North Korea. Then we got a buyer from North Korea to buy it. And we got the Japanese whalers to deliver it to Australia to us.
Oh, wow.
They were not very happy when they found out they had delivered it to us.
No. What is the status of Japanese whaling today?
They are continuing to go down into the Southern Ocean. Their quota is now 333 instead of 1,035. The reason we can't oppose them is because they're investing about $50 million a year in to subsidize that fleet, and that includes real-time satellite technology, so they can see where we are at any given moment. Mm. I mean, the best we can do is know where they were 24 hours ago. But so it's impossible to close in. I mean, Adam went down there in 2017 and just couldn't get close, within 50 miles maybe, but they would always see where we were. So it's sort of a waste of energy and money to pursue something we can't catch. But on the positive side, they have to spend $50 million a year to ensure that that continues to happen that way. But it also freed us up to go after probably even a greater threat to the ocean, which is overfishing. And so we're doing that. We're also right now opposing Japan's no longer the number one whaling country in the world. Iceland is.
Uh-huh.
So we have a crew in Iceland right now.
And why are they killing whales?
Well, the Icelanders are killing them primarily for two reasons. One, to sell to the Japanese, and two, because they sell about 30,000 whale meals in their restaurants to tourists every year, primarily American tourists, eco-tourists, who go there to experience the Icelandic way of life. So they go out whale watching, then come back and have a whale steak that evening.
Do they know it's whale?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's forbidden in the U.S., so we're going to have it.
Wow.
Personally, I think eco-tourism is a great threat to our planet.
Elaborate on that. Why?
Well, for instance, in Galapagos, you know, in 1999 when we first went there, it was about 50,000 tourists a year. Now it's 350,000. Right. And all of these guys want to stay in good hotels, so they're knocking down mangrove swamps to build eco-tourist hotels. And, of course, they all want to eat fish, so they've got to catch more fish, and they all want to eat steak, so therefore they've got to bring cows over and all sorts of problems. So things have gone downhill considerably because of that. You know, there's two types of people in the world, travelers and tourists. I like travelers. Travelers travel here and there. They experience life as the people there experience it. But tourists, they got to have the best of everything, and they're the real problem.
That's true.
Well, so what would you say to people who think they're doing the right thing by going on an eco tour?
Well, they're not. You know, put a pack sack on.
Yeah, go for
put
a
pack sack
woods,
on
like the old days.
And go up there. You know, I traveled in 72. I spent a year traveling through Europe with a pack on my back. It cost me $1,000 for the whole year.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way to travel. Mm. 50 cents a night in a pension in Greece or something like this.
Captain Paul Watson is founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and Captain Adam Meyerson was chief officer on the Bob Barker for Operation Ice Fish. I hope you can watch the documentary Chasing the Thunder, and that campaign is the subject of that film. How long have you been working on the boats and with the Sea Shepherd?
I started in 2011.
Okay.
It was, yeah. It started as a second mate on the Steve Irwin.
So I wonder, you know, because every Monday we do a show about climate change, overfishing, plastic pollution, you name it. We're going to do a show about how so many seals are starving. Mm. There's a great marine mammal center here in Sausalito.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so many of the seals that they're rehabilitating are starving because of climate change. The fish that they mm-hmm. eat are further down in the ocean, and they can't dive that far.
Not just seals. Orcas are dying.
Orcas, right, everything. Right. Yeah. That mom that was carrying her baby for 17 days. So we talk about these issues, and we have on all kinds of scientists and activists, amazing people. But I wonder, from your perspective, since you're out on the water and you've been doing this work for so long, how do you see this issue? I mean, there's more awareness being raised, but we're taking so many steps backwards, especially with the Trump administration in office.
Well, it's not just Trump. It's like the world leaders all over the world.
Right.
I mean, they're doing the same thing.
Right.
For instance, I don't see any difference between Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau, except that Donald Trump denies climate change. Trudeau doesn't, but Trudeau's more of a problem than Trump is when it comes to the tar sands and everything like that. They're all hypocrites, really, when you get right down to it. Mm. But the problem is that humanity as a whole or ecologically insane is really what you get right down to it. When are we going to change? When Mother Nature kicks us in the rear end. And I'm thinking like an ecological collapse of some nature, hopefully not too serious, but enough to send a strong, strong message. We simply cannot continue to overstress ecological systems the way we're doing. By 2025, there won't be any coral reefs anywhere in the world. That'll be the first complete destruction of global ecosystems all over the world. And for the most part, we deal with that by denial. Mm-hmm. Or just, well, what are you going to do? What can you do? Well, there's a lot you can do. And what I've learned through social movements, the history of social movements over the centuries, is that don't depend upon governments to solve your problems. Governments cause problems. It has to be the passion of people from around the world. That's what ended slavery. That's what got women the right to vote in this country. That was the civil rights movement. It has to become from the passion of people. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, in fact, well, on the good side of that, I'm seeing more and more of that now than I did, say, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Right. I mean, I feel like there's a climate march, especially in the Bay Area, every month or so. I mean, big one. 2025, coral reefs dead?
That's what, according to the Coral Reef Society, then they had that conference in 2011. That was what their prediction was on that.
I'm just thinking, like, we're in 2018
it's right around the corner
now.
Yeah, I know. It's not very far away. And 2048 is not very far away either for the collapse of the world's fisheries.
That are going on. I mean, it's happening right now, you know,
it's like,
starving.
And again, we're in denial of that, right? You know, what's happened with those orcas up in there? There hasn't been a survival of a baby orca in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And, people are very cynical about it, but what was that all about with that mother carrying? That's never happened before.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at an extremely intelligent creature. And to me, it's actually the reality of that movie Happy Feet. Trying to deliver a message to humanity. Mm-hmm. That's what she was doing. Mm-hmm. She knew people were watching. And the other pod were trying to send a message. And people say, well, you know, that's anthropomorphizing everything. What I see is a clear message being sent. I don't care what you call it. Yeah. And one of the reasons that they're having – one of the things, our vessel, the Martin Sheen, is up in British Columbia right now opposing salmon farms.
Mm.
And a lot of people think, well, salmon farms are the solution. Salmon farms are destroying our planet, you know, really, because of transmission of viruses and parasites from farms to the wild salmon populations from a species that doesn't belong there. It's an exotic. It's a predator. If I were to put a couple of piranhas in a lake, that would be a serious problem. But they can just throw these predatory alien species into an ecosystem and cause havoc. And because it makes $1 billion a year, and that's one of the reasons, of course, you see so much salmon in sushi bars and everywhere else.
Right.
And I don't even know why people eat this stuff, because the color of the meat isn't even real. It's actually an artificial dye put into the food pellets, because farm-raised salmon have a dirty white flesh, and nobody's going to buy that.
Mm-hmm. We're going to do a whole show about the mom who was carrying her baby for 17 days. And it was so interesting, because so many people around the world were watching this constantly. And I just wondered, you know, what do you understand why this is really happening? Do you understand how this happened?
Well, the other problem we have is a media pollution. That is, so much is happening all the time that what happened, by 2 weeks from now, nobody will even remember it.
Right.
You know, it just goes from one crisis to the next. We forget it from the week before. And so the real problem is the media, and the same. You know, I mean, you know, Trump goes on about fake media and everything. There is fake media, and we've been saying that for years, but not in the way he's saying it. It's just the fake media is what they choose to cover or not cover. They're covering him because he's entertainment, but they're not covering the real problems in the world.
Right.
And that's just being completely ignored. So one ecological crisis to another, even the forest fires are not even being covered with any considerable degree of, you know, concern.
Right. What would you add, Adam? I mean, I think the media, they're making a ton of money off of Trump. And, you know, we didn't even get one question about climate change in the presidential election.
No, and there was no debate about it. And we have entire organizations like the Wall Street Journal that are dedicated just to reporting about economics. There's a huge industry behind reporting on the economics. Economics is a made-up thing. It doesn't even exist. And we spend millions of hours and thousands of millions of dollars reporting and tracking and keeping track of this made-up thing. Well, meanwhile, the ecological system, which is a real thing and has real consequences, is ignored.
And the Democrats,
we don't do anything about it.
The Democrats are just as guilty. They won't address it.
No, and but economics is a big thing. Oh, we can't do that. It's economically devastating. What about ecologically devastating? Oh, that's all right.
You know, I voted for the Green Party. People say, oh, you threw your vote away. And I said, no, I didn't. I voted for what I believed in. You know, and you people got to get away from this two-party Republican system and start voting for people who are actually going to do something.
Yeah.
Did you see a major difference between Obama and Trump on the environment?
Well, there's differences, but not that substantial. Uh-huh. Obama signed a bill making it illegal to sue Monsanto. That's something that you would expect from Trump, really. Uh-huh. Obama didn't do anything about stopping the war and bombing people and everything like that. Compared to Trump, of course, he looks really good.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Compared to Trump, George Bush looks wonderful. Compared to Trump, Richard Nixon's an angel.
I think George Bush every day wakes up and goes, I'm not the worst president anymore.
Yeah, but when you consider it, I mean, Richard Nixon actually was good for the environment.
Yeah. He did the Clean Water Act, right?
Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, Equal Rights for Women Act, assault things, end of the war in Vietnam. This guy was actually the greatest president of the 20th century, but he unfortunately made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
Captain Paul Watson is the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and we're also joined today by Captain Adam Meyerson, who's been with Sea Shepherd since 2011. And check out a trailer for the documentary Chasing the Thunder at yourcallradio.org. The other thing I do when we have on scientists, academics, authors, what have you, is to say, okay, what three changes would you make to tackle climate change? And I feel like everybody's on kind of a different, they give different answers.
Sure.
Or they can't articulate it in a way that I can tell my family at Thanksgiving, this is what we need to do tomorrow.
Don't eat the turkey on Thanksgiving. Well, there's a big one right there.
Definitely not. But what would you say?
I would say stop eating meat and dairy. You know, go vegan is one of the biggest things you can do for climate change. Mm. Then, of course, the other thing is limiting your use of power and, you know, vis-a-vis driving cars and all the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more important than that is the vegan thing and plastics are the two biggest things you can easily change in your life without having to change your job, where you live, how you live at all, really. It's simple to go vegan and simple to start bringing a cup with you where you go and drinking out of the faucet like we used to when I was a kid. You know, those are just easy changes to make. So I'd say that's the simplest, easiest way.
And all of the Sea Shepherd boats are vegan.
Yes. And we also have to shut down all industrialized fishing operations. That's, if we don't, then the ocean is doomed. But the reason, a lot of people say, well, why are Sea Shepherd ships vegan? I mean, it's a little extreme. It isn't. If you understand what the problem is, then we have to set an example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to be vegan to join our crew, but you have to be vegan while you're on the crew.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are introduced to a vegan lifestyle that way, and it's amazing how many people actually convert because they've been introduced to something that says, oh my God, I didn't starve to death, I'm still alive.
Yep.
You know, there's a great film that just came out by Luis Soyos on The Game Changers about vegan athletes, mm-hmm. and how they're actually better than that. So, you know, that's probably the way to approach it. I mean, if you could sell somebody on the thing, this is going to make you look younger, stronger, and whatever, then they're going to go for it. They don't care.
Yeah.
You
know?
Well, what would you say, Paul? I mean, we're talking about major policy changes.
Mm-hmm.
Shutting down illegal fishing.
That has to be done.
Yeah.
And not only shutting down illegal fishing, shutting down all industrialized fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of all that heavy gear, those nets and everything like that.
Oh, yes.
You know, we're always going to have fishing, because there's so many countries that depend upon it. But they got to go out in their little boats with their whatever and catch the fish. That's fine. And if they're feeding their families, you know, we can't do anything about that. But these large corporate things, I mean, is there any reason why we have to have a fish caught in Antarctica sold in a restaurant in Denver? I mean, do we really have to have that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this is the problem. And of course, these sushi restaurants are everywhere, you know, and they're catching everything left, right, and center.
I'm glad you brought up the gill nets. We haven't talked about that yet. Because in the film, Chasing the Thunder, we see these massive, massive nets. They go down 2 kilometers. They run up to 130 kilometers long. I mean, this is, and they catch everything. It's
totally
like catching an entire neighborhood.
Yeah, it's strip mining the ocean, or it's like clear cutting, really. And the waste in the fishing industry is incredible. The amount, like for instance, every kilo of shrimp caught represents 22 kilos of something else that was destroyed in order to get it.
Groups like the Monterey Bay Institute have this sustainable card. Mm. And a lot of people who come on the show say, well, don't eat this fish, but this fish is okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sea Shepherd has been asked many times to come with a sustainable seafood card. And we said, yeah, well, it'll be a blank piece of paper. There is no sustainable fishery. I mean, the one you could argue, just to be, you know, fair about this, is Alaska salmon, because it's from the hatcheries and it's wild caught and everything like that. But that'd be the only one that even comes close to a sustainable fishery.
And you're still taking all that food out of the ocean that would be eaten by other things in the ocean. So mm-hmm. it doesn't matter. I always think of what the world would think if I took two trucks and I put a big net and I drove through the park catching birds, you know, in the net and every other thing that was going by, and then I took mm-hmm. them in and I started barbecuing them out on the side of the street. It's no different than the ocean. It's just that you don't see it yeah. because the net's under the water.
Right.
People would attack the truck, you know, well, driving along.
We criticize Africans in the jungle for this thing called bushmeat.
Yeah.
You know, because they're taking giraffe and everything else. But there's no difference. A bluefin tuna is aquatic bushmeat.
Exactly.
There's no difference. But because so-called civilized people are eating it, suddenly that's acceptable.
Mm. Yeah.
Have you seen any major changes from governments that you think are hopeful?
From governments? I think that there's people in governments that are trying to do things like the people we've been working with in Mexico. I think they're sincere about wanting to protect mm-hmm. the vaquita. I think there's people in Africa who are sincere about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult because there's one branch does one thing, the other branch doesn't. Like, for instance, a very good friend of mine is now the environment minister for France.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was incredible when he was a civilian.
mm-hmm.
He's now, everybody hates him because,
yeah.
and I said, he said, well, I can't do anything.
Wow.
I simply can't do anything. I get overruled by the Minister of Agriculture. I get overruled by the Minister of Energy. I simply can't do anything. So, you know, he's basically sacrificed his entire reputation trying to do something which he can't do within that system.
Hmm. It's the system.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even though you have the best intentions, for instance, the Minister for Environment for British Columbia,
mm-hmm.
she came out very hardcore against fish farms and everything, and suddenly it gets in the news. Next thing, the Prime Minister or the Premier calls her in and said, back off.
Don't do
it. You know, too much pressure from the industry, mm-hmm. and then just back off. So even when they try to do something, that's why I don't think you can change things in government. I really don't. You know, you get in there and you're just part of that whole system.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S. government, there's a lot of people who work for NOAA. There's a lot of people who work for the EPA.
Right.
They're very sincere and they want to do things. I knew a guy who was with the EPA, and he said for 20 years he couldn't do anything that he wanted to do. He said, in fact, I actually have done more with Sea Shepherd than I ever could do when I was within the EPA. You know, so the people within these offices, within these bureaucracies, I think there's a lot of really, I mean, that's how they got there, because they wanted to actually contribute and do something positive. But once they get in there, their hands are tied.
Oddly enough, they're very free to do the wrong thing in there. Once they get in, you know, it's easy to destroy things. It's much harder to protect things.
So social movements, are you heartened by the activism that we're seeing? I mean, Indigenous activism as a result of Standing Rock has completely exploded. And, I mean, here in California, people like to prop up Jerry Brown as this green governor, and yet climate activists are saying, excuse me, what about fracking? What about taking money from big oil? I mean, they're putting him... holding him accountable.
And that's good, because I've known Jerry Brown since 1975, and I've always thought he was a good guy. But he's, again, somebody who's come under enormous pressure from all those various things. And so the Jerry Brown in 1975 is not the Jerry Brown of 2018.
So you're both hopeful when you look at the social movements that are happening?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I mean, I definitely see people standing up more and more, and I think it's a result of things have gotten so bad.
Yeah.
You know, and if we had continued on sort of in this simmering, you know, where the frog, that the water suddenly got turned up and people are starting to jump out of the pot and realize that we can't just keep going on the way we are. I mean, you can see that all the things that people were talking about 20 years ago, oh, this is going to happen, we're going to have forest fires, we're going to have bigger tornadoes, we're going to have worse hurricanes. It's happening right now, you know,
it's gone by.
That's because God's mad at us because of the gates.
Oh, is that what it is?
Captain Adam Meyerson has been with the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society since 2011, doing amazing work around the world. Captain Paul Watson is the founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, the world's most active marine protection nonprofit. Captain Paul and Captain Adam, thank you for all the work you do, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar.